WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The ACLU recently announced its selection of the Arts Censors of the Year, a list of private individuals and public officials the ACLU says have shown exceptional disregard for the First Amendment and artistic expression. The list includes Anna Melda Radice, acting chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. She was chosen for agreeing to veto grants for sexually explicit art. Reverend Donald Wildman is cited for a lifetime of disservice to the values of the Bill of Rights in his pursuit of one goal, the restructuring of American law to reflect his own moral code. We called Marjorie Hines, the director of the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project, which made the selections. I asked her if there is a theme that unites the individuals chosen as Arts Censors of the Year.
Well, the main theme that emerges is, regardless of what their particular political ideology is, and some of them are quote-unquote feminists like Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, and some of them are religious right fundamentalists like Donald Wildman, but what unites them all is an intolerance for the viewpoints of others, and a desire to impose their particular ideology, be it religious or political or both, on society, on everybody else, by suppressing, silencing, and punishing creative expression that they disagree with.
Let's look at some of the recipients of your Art Censors of the Year awards, and you've divided this into two categories, government art censors and private art censors.
Right.
Why don't we start with government art censors, and you have the Duval County, Florida Public School District on your list. What happened there?
Well, there are a lot of public school districts around the country that have, either because they have on their own boards people who want to impose a particular ideological agenda, or because they are responding to pressures from groups of parents, small groups of parents. But all of them, the Duval County, Florida Public School District, their name has come up repeatedly. And they have removed more than 60 books over the last couple of years from the school library, including many, many classics, J.D. Salinger, William Faulkner. And this year they removed Snow White, the fairy tale, because somebody objected to its violence. The problem of purging books from school libraries in response to ideological pressure groups is a very serious one.
The Omaha City Councilman Steve Exon makes your list.
Well, Steve Exon decided to go on a crusade against rap music and joined up with a group in Omaha called Omaha for Decency, and they organized a sting operation. They sent teenagers into music stores, and a number of them were able to purchase, or so they alleged, the latest Two Live Crew recording. And then Exxon prevailed upon the prosecutor in Omaha to prosecute these record store owners under the state harmful to minors laws for the crime of selling music.
And you have a problem with prosecuting record store owners for selling records?
It's really prosecuting musicians and music store owners for the crime of obscenity or disseminating material harmful to minors is really very new development in the United States, and it's very troubling because all art forms by their nature are ambiguous, and it's very hard to argue that there's anything, that there should be anything criminal about art. And music is especially so. You've got sound, you've got rhythm, and you've got lyrics. And to try to separate out lyrics from the rest of a musical production and then criminally prosecute musicians or music stores is alarming.
Well, this kind of ties in with a couple of people who made your list of the private art censors of the year, Oliver North and Jack Thompson, who led a campaign against Ice-T's song Cop Killer. Now, this is the same Oliver North of the Iran-Contra affair.
It is, and he now has created a private organization for himself, which I gather is promoting what he views as correct, politically correct patriotic values. And one of his issues now is the dangers so-called dangers of words and music. And he was really a leader in the crusade to suppress this song, Cop Killer, which is an example of a whole genre of rap music, which is highly politicized, highly radical, and highly critical of the powers that be, and in particular the police and their behavior in minority communities. And so it's very dangerous when you see whether government or private individuals flexing their muscles in a way that silences and suppresses a point of view that needs to be heard.
Okay, so Oliver North, you say, was leading this campaign against Ice-T's record Cop Killer. Who is Jack Thompson?
Thompson is a lawyer in Florida who originally achieved notoriety by becoming very actively involved in the prosecutions a couple of years ago of Two Live Crew for obscenity. And ultimately, all of those prosecutions were unsuccessful, although in one case it took 2 years to get a lower court decision reversed. When it came to Cop Killer and this category of rap called gangster rap, obscenity prosecutions are really not a viable option because, for the most part, the music is not about sex. It's about politics and racism. And so North and Thompson got the idea that they would try to get prosecutions of this singer and Time Warner, his producer, under sedition laws or anarchy laws, because they thought that this music was politically radical and revolutionary and therefore should be suppressed. And that's what they were advocating. They haven't yet gotten any state or local prosecutor to bring such a prosecution, probably because it would be clearly unconstitutional, but that is what they have attempted.
You're saying that these rap records are about politics and racism, and that's why people object to it, but isn't it really because people interpret the records as advocating violence and, in this instance, advocating killing police?
Again, you know, a piece of music, a piece of poetry, a piece of art, it's very hard to narrow it down or reduce something that is a work of the imagination or fantasy and is complicated to a simple message. And you could take innumerable examples from the visual arts, film, novels. A lot of our art describes crime, so that I wouldn't necessarily agree that the song advocates violence against police officers. But even if it did, the law is pretty clear that the First Amendment protects even incendiary speech, even advocacy of violence, unless it rises to the level of actual incitement. It's pretty clear that you can't sue an artist or a record company for producing a work that documents, describes, arguably even advocates. If you had such a crime, if you had such a rule of law, number one, you would be letting the criminal off the hook. And in this country, under our legal system, we give people responsibility for their actions. And there's a clear differentiation between words, thoughts, emotions, and fantasies on the one hand and antisocial acts on the other. And we don't let criminals off the hook because they heard a record or read a book. If we did, incidentally, the Bible would have to be the first work of art to be banned because there's probably more documentation of psychopathic criminals claiming inspiration from the Bible, whether for murders, for child abuse, for wife beating. So we don't allow people to escape criminal responsibility.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marjorie Hines, and she's the project director of the ACLU Arts Censorship Project. They recently released their list of the Art Censors of the Year. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Marjorie Hines is my guest. She directs the ACLU Arts Censorship Project. You know, in large part because of the Parents Music Resource Center, the group that was co-founded by Tip Agore, the record industry has instituted a voluntary labeling system. I wonder what you think of that, if you think of that as self-censorship.
Well, it's certainly self-censorship. It's not a First Amendment matter, technically, because the record industry is not the government, and the First Amendment only prevents the government from engaging in censorship. It was clearly a response to pressures, to political pressures that were brought to bear on the industry. the industry was hoping that, I suppose, that as a result of voluntary self-censorship, it would not have to face legislation, mandatory labeling, or other kinds of government-imposed censorship. I think they were mistaken, because what we've seen in the years since the parental advisory label came into effect is a couple of very dangerous things. One is proposed legislation in a number of states, and it hasn't been passed anywhere yet, but in Louisiana last year, it was saved from passage only by a governor's veto. Legislation which relies on the parental advisory warning to trigger criminal penalties for sales to minors. And those laws would be unconstitutional, but they can do a lot of harm before they're struck down in the courts. Number two, even without laws that rely on the label, we're seeing a lot of music stores, especially the bigger chains that have leases and malls, simply saying, we will not carry labeled music. And undoubtedly, the impact of this is discriminatory against rap and rock music. You don't see country music getting labeled. You don't see opera getting labeled, even though the lyrics may be just as steamy and suggestive.
Going down the list of private art censors, you have Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who you cite for drafting and advocating legislation that would allow lawsuits to ban sexually oriented entertainment and to allow victims of sexual crimes to collect damages from the producers and distributors of such entertainment.
Dworkin and McKinnon are very important to recognize as censors. I should say that, like the other private individuals we've named, they obviously have First Amendment rights to advocate what they advocate, and we would defend their right to do so. But we also think it's important to point out that what they are advocating is censorship, and if they are successful, we will have a suppression of art that may be valuable and that people certainly have a right to choose and make decisions about for themselves.
What McKinnon and Dworkin are advocating is if a woman is a victim of a sex crime, that what? Who should she be able to,
well,
to sue?
Two things. The original ordinance that they drafted and that was enacted in Indianapolis and then struck down by the courts would have allowed anybody, essentially, who was offended by a work of what they defined as pornography, and they have their own particular definition of pornography, which is quite different from any court definition we've seen of obscenity. But anything that met that definition, anybody essentially could sue to stop it. And a very straightforward kind of censorship. And what they were trying to get at was material that they felt was degrading to women or insulting to women. That law was properly struck down by the courts because, first of all, it's incredibly subjective. Second of all, government is not permitted to suppress any type of speech based on the viewpoint that's expressed, even if it's a viewpoint we don't like.
One last question for you. You're a First Amendment lawyer who is now focusing on the arts and civil liberties. Has it given you any new insights into First Amendment law or into American culture, you know, to be focusing on the arts as you have been?
It has made me, I think, more of a principled First Amendment believer. I won't say we all, but many, many Americans, probably the majority, believe in free speech in the abstract. But for almost all of us, there is something that pushes our envelope, and we begin to waver in our principles, and we think, oh, well, that is so awful. Surely the government should be allowed to suppress or punish it. Working in this area, sometimes with songs or images or performers whose work is very disturbing or shocking to some people has given me a better understanding of the importance of allowing that creativity to be expressed. Ultimately, that helps, that not only does freedom of expression not cause actual crimes or other harms to society, but it really helps. It's a safety valve to allow that expression, for example, the expressions of rage that we hear in rap music. That's a form of safety valve. And it gets the information out there. so that society can respond, hopefully, with positive changes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for your interest a lot.
Marjorie Hines directs the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project.